Albert Bierstadt, born Germany, 1830 to 1902. Seal Rock, circa 1872 to 87, oil on canvas. Bierstadt's family settled in New Bedford, Massachusetts when he was a child. In 1853, Bierstadt returned to Germany and studied at the Dusseldorf Academy with American painters Emanuel Leutze and Worthington Whitridge. After 4 years abroad, studying and traveling to Switzerland, where he painted and sketched in the Alps, Bierstadt returned to the United States to pursue his newly learned techniques. In 1859, Bierstadt made his first trip to the American West. By 1871, when he went for the third time, he was probably the best-known landscape painter in America. During this trip, he ventured out to the rugged and rocky Farallon Islands, which lie 26 miles west of San Francisco. He spent several days sketching the sea lions, birds, and relentless waves. Upon Bierstadt's return, the San Francisco Bulletin reported, "He has procured sketches for paintings of the isles and will doubtless give us a faithful likeness." Over the next 15 years, Bierstadt would produce at least 6 major paintings, including Seal Rock, from these sketches. All are romanticized scenes highlighting life's tenacious ability to flourish in even the harshest environments. Mary Stevenson Cassatt, 1845 to 1926. A Caress. Une Caresse, Maternal Love, La Caresse de l'Enfant, Baby's First Caress, Mother's Caress, The First Caress, Jeune Mère, Child and Nurse, 1891. Pastel on Paper. Cassatt was born to a privileged family and spent much of her youth abroad. She lived in Philadelphia from 1861 to 1865 and studied at the Pennsylvania Academy before settling permanently in Paris. She exhibited regularly at the Salon from 1868 to 1876. In 1877, Degas invited her to exhibit with the Impressionists, whom she joined from 1879 to 1886. During this time, she developed the themes that would characterize her oeuvre, women and children engaged in domestic activities. At her death, Cassatt was considered by many to be America's leading female artist. A Caress was shown in 1891 at Cassatt's solo exhibition at the prestigious Galerie Durand-Ruelle in Paris. Her confident technique belies the difficulties of working in pastel. In the flat surfaces and subject matter, the work reveals the influence of Japanese prints, which she had studied. The theme also owes a debt to the Western tradition of representations of the Madonna and Child. Cassatt's close friend and patron, Luzine Havemeyer, bought the pastel in 1895, just before the opening of the artist's first major American retrospective. Because it was a favorite, Havemeyer did not bequeath it to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, along with the rest of the Havemeyer collection, but gave it to her daughter, Electra Havemeyer Webb, the founder of the Shelburne Museum, whose own daughter sold it months before her house burned to the ground. Dale Chihuly, born 1941. Blue and Beyond Blue, 2006. Glass. Chihuly was born in Tacoma, Washington, and attended the University of Washington in Seattle, where he studied interior design and architecture. After graduating in 1965, Chihuly went on to earn a degree in glass blowing from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and an MFA in sculpture from the Rhode Island School of Design, where he later established the school's glass program. In 1968, Chihuly was awarded a Fulbright Fellowship and went on to become the first American glass blower to work in the prestigious Vanini Fabbrica on the island of Murano near Venice. It was here that Chihuly absorbed the master and team collaborative approach that he has continued in his own studio in the United States. In 1971, Chihuly co-founded the Pilchuck Glass School in Stanwood, Washington, and is credited for leaving the avant-garde development of glass as a fine art. Chihuly lives and works in his loft, which is nicknamed the Boathouse for its former use on Lake Union in Seattle, Washington. Since losing vision in one of his eyes in an automobile accident in 1976, Chihuly no longer has the depth perception necessary to handle the molten glass himself. He now conceptualizes each project with paint on canvas and then employs a team of artists to fabricate his designs. Chihuly's work reflects his love for Washington as well as his interest in the ocean and the creatures that inhabit it. His vibrant, curvaceous sculptures explore dynamic color combined with natural forms, and he often displays his sculpture in outdoor surroundings, entwined around tree branches or floating in water. His work has been exhibited in over 200 museums, and he has been the recipient of many awards, including 7 honorary doctorates and 2 fellowships from the National Endowment of the Arts. Chihuly's complex, multi-part pieces are a tour de force of luminous color and organic shapes. He is best known for his series of works including baskets, sea forms, and Persians, in addition to large-scale architectural installations. In 1991, he embarked on the international project Chihuly Over Venice, which involved glass factories in Finland, Ireland, and Mexico, and culminated in sculptures installed over the canals and piazzas of Venice. This chandelier is part of Chihuly's sculptural exploration of sea forms, which are rendered by the writhing, sinuous, tentacle-like shapes that seem to coil and slither around themselves. The 257 intricate parts of this sculpture came together as a cohesive whole, demonstrating his mastery of form and design. Saul LeWitt, 1928 to 2007. Wall drawing number 1196, Scribbles, December 2005. Graphite on prepared sheetrock. Wall drawing number 1196, Scribbles, represents a recent masterpiece by LeWitt. His wall drawings have been best described as minimalist maximalism because they are simple in form but monumental in scale. 6 assistants worked for over 2 weeks to complete the painstaking process. Working with pencils, they enlarged LeWitt's original concept so that it is now 13 feet 7 inches high by 27 feet 7 inches long. Each column looks like a light and dark funnel of dust or the vortex of a tornado. One critic likened each to the residue from a giant exhaust pipe. Light on the outside and dark at the center, each column stands next to another, forming a ceremonial gate. LeWitt indicated, when he examined the completed drawing in December 2005, that he had been inspired to undertake this series by studying a vintage photograph of a spiral staircase by Clarence Laughlin, 1905 to 1985, in his collection. Because of the drawing's size and complexity, the cumulative effect on the viewer is sublime. LeWitt, a New Britain native, was the subject of 3 exhibitions at the museum, which was the first art institution to display his work. Today, the museum houses over 1,500 examples by LeWitt the acknowledged genius of the international conceptual art movement. Thomas Hart Benton, 1889 to 1975. The Arts of Life in America, Arts of the City, 1932. Egg Tempera on Panel. Arts of the City is the largest and most complex section of the mural cycle. The rectangular cutout represents the location of windows in the original room. The economic hardship endured by millions of Americans in the 1930s is most obvious in the pathetic portrait on the far left at the back of a grown man desperate for food, rummaging through a garbage can. In the foreground at the left, one man bites on a piece of bread and sips coffee, while another bystander passively stands nearby. The upper left section features strutting beauty queens and a leering judge, while to his right, two revelers are caught in a drunken embrace. The center section elevates cocktail mixing to an art form in the figure of the statuesque woman on the left in front of a bar. Below her are three caricatures. The man with the gun appears to be a common thug. An equally shady character of ample girth wears a natty suit, puffs on a cigar, while resting his pudgy right hand on his back. A more detached, elegant investment banker type stands shadowing both of them. Machinery, part of a steam engine, and a bootlegger's still surround this trio who represent three distinct classes in the food chain of entrepreneurs. The right section represents more overtly creative pursuits. Our attention is arrested by the buxom diva and her crooning partner posed in front of a microphone. The ghostly winged figure may represent a personification of radio, only recently a major addition to home entertainment. They are accompanied by a blind piano player. A pair of synchronized dancers are glimpsed on a stage in the center distance. During the Depression, films provided a relatively inexpensive means of escape from the monotony of daily life. Separated from the radio vignette by a swirl of color in the form of a curtain, Benton's silver screen is occupied by a glamorous pair of dancers, while the audience is reduced to one patron precariously standing on crutches. The only other figure in this vignette appears to be a burlesque performer adjusting her shoe. In the final sequence, Benton painted two African-American wing musicians and a handsome pair elegantly dancing. The small boy on the right reading a newspaper with a chum is Benton's young son, T.P. The voluptuous woman at her dressing table is literally bursting out from beneath her skimpy clothing. Benton's city folk are a cross-section of humanity struggling with economic adversity, who attempt to rise above their ordinary existences through music, dance, drinking, attending films, and even applying their makeup, the best possible face to put on a bad situation. Like the artist himself, his characters are down to earth, even bawdy, and represent the bustling metropolis, New York, which Benton believed was the greatest city on the planet, despite the trying times in which he lived.